This is A People's Climate, powered by Wild Seeds Fund, from Counterstream Media and The Nation. I'm your host, Shilpi Chotre.
For generations, Gaza's farmland has been a lifeline, but now that lifeline is being erased.
Thousands upon thousands of Israeli and Western-supplied bombs dropped on Gaza bring not just death, but a toxic legacy from explosive chemicals. Dust and debris from destroyed buildings pollute the air and ground. Israel's military offensive in Gaza is leaving a new layer of toxic chemicals in its soil.
An unusual environmental project has opened in the West Bank over the past week, a seed library.
She's a botanist collecting heirloom seeds for a new national program to preserve and share them.
Vivian Sansour has been on a mission to track down threatened heirloom crops. She says they're falling victim to competition from industrialized agriculture, as well as loss of land to Israeli settlements.
But what we want to do with the seed library is to allow people to become part of the seed library themselves. So everybody is responsible. Everybody's responsible to take the seed, plant and make seed and bring it back.
When I had this conversation back in July, a ceasefire in Gaza hadn't yet been declared, and even now, Israel continues to violate it. For over 2 years now, the world has watched a genocide unfold. It has destroyed an entire people's land, contaminated their water, polluted their air, and erased their food systems. And yet, so many environmentalists remain silent. They fail to see the connection. If you call yourself a conservationist, if you care about the environment, you must be anti-genocide. On the front lines of environmental protections are farmers, seed savers, and land stewards. Which brings us to today's guest, Vivian Sansour. She is the founder of the Palestine Heirloom Seed Library. Our conversation is about food and farming, but it's also about liberation and the deep cost of ignoring the political roots of environmental colonialism. Welcome to the show, Vivian. Thank you so much for taking the time, the space, and your emotional energy to have this conversation with me today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Nice to meet you.
I actually want to start with something that's been weighing on me quite heavily. You know, we talk so much in this movement about protecting the land and water, about regenerative agriculture, about food justice. But when it has come to Palestine, where people in Gaza are facing 22 months of genocide and are now being deliberately starved, there's this deafening silence in environmental and climate spaces. You yourself are a conservationist. Can you explain the connection not only to the humanitarian violence, but to deep ecological violence as well?
Thank you for bringing this up and actually for starting with that. It's been difficult to have conversations with folks who want to speak about things in very fancy terms and talk about words like sustainability, conservation, ecology, as if it exists in a void of our political reality. It's actually impossible to be environmentalist and not political because the air we breathe is political. The fact that we are having to come up with new ways of dealing with our planet collapse is actually very political because it's the product of our choices, of our behaviors and our policies around the world, not just in Palestine. The reality is our planet is already in a hospice state. Many things we love are dying. Many people we love are dying and they're disappearing forever. And the fact that we are behaving as if things are isolated and not connected is actually not naive. It's very dangerous. I'll just keep in my little bubble and pretend the world around me is not burning, that there are no fires in California, that there are no genocides around the world, including Congo, Haiti, Palestine, and Sudan. And obviously, we always can trace back to the same oppressive engine. So if we're not going to talk about that and pretend that the world is fine when the world is not fine, is actually plain stupid. I mean, I don't usually speak in such language, but it, at this point, if you don't see that this is coming to your backyard, then you're intentionally burying yourself in a big lie and hoping that it won't come to you.
Thank you for breaking that down so clearly. A big reason why I wanted to have you on the show is to show just how powerful the work of saving heirloom seeds really is and, you know, what it means to protect these living pieces of Palestine.
Yeah, actually, pieces of Palestine is an accurate sentence, unfortunately, and it hurts me to hear it from someone else because I obviously feel it and know it, that we've been broken into pieces. But yes, the Palestine Heirloom Seed Library actually was born out of this grief, the loss of things we love, the loss of so much beauty, the loss of practices that are ecological by nature. They have been passed down and practiced for millennia, literally. The fact that we eat charred fava beans today is a practice from literally more than 10,000 years ago. A cuisine that has been passed down to you with your ancestral lineage going back thousands of years ago feels different in terms of relation to land. I grew up in a different Palestine. I grew up in a Palestine that was very much Palestine of the seasons, Palestine of sharing fruits with your neighbor. Like in my village, we are famous for our apricots. We have an apricot that's called Mistikawi. It's a rare variety. And yet it's also threatened now because there's no place to plant it anymore. We have been completely surrounded by the wall, by checkpoints, by settlements. And even the land that we still have some of these trees, we are no longer able to access it. The army issued a new rule that anyone being found walking on these agricultural lands, you could be arrested and fined, that it's illegal to be on your land. And so what does that mean? If it's illegal for me to be on my land, where am I supposed to go? And this is the land, again, that we've been cultivating and living with for thousands of years. So the seed library came out of that grief, of an attempt to save some of these pieces, some of these stories, some of these remnants of a tender past.
I would love to ask about Batir, which I read about is an ancient farming village, which is now threatened by Israeli expansion, even though it is a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
These are the biblical terraces of Batir, and we call them biblical because they're over 2,000 years of age. My ancestors came here and carved these terraces into the mountains. It was the only way for them to survive.
All of this land belongs to a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And right here, Israel's just announced its plans to build a new settlement.
The new settlement to be built, named Nahal Helitz, is the first one Israel has approved since 2017.
Last Thursday, Israel's Prime Minister signed an expansion plan, one of the biggest pushes for Israeli settlements in decades.
We said there would be no Palestinian state, and indeed there will be no Palestinian state.
It just happens that a friend of mine who has a lot of grape vines and olive groves woke up to find that his irrigation pipes have been cut off, his water tank has been stolen, and his land destroyed by a group of settlers. And so Batir is not a unique example, unfortunately. Batir, we first of all had to fight for a UNESCO heritage site. One can say naively or in a hopeful manner, people thought that maybe if Batir had UNESCO heritage site, it would be protected. But as we know from what's happening right now, a genocide is being televised and yet no one's doing anything. So whether it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site or whatever, the UN itself is not doing anything. It's all talk, talk, talk. And the world is very comfortable, actually, watching the deterioration of these villages. There is so much investment in oh, we're building an ecological building. Oh, this is a green building and it's $3 million. I always say, instead of having so much energy in supposedly building an ecological world, because you have already destroyed the world, there are still villages and people who are guardians of these trees, of this biodiversity. And so why not, instead of pretending that you are creating a new ecological world, just protect or at least stop bombing the world that already exists?
We're not asking for much.
No.
One of the things I was startled by is, in addition to the settlement expansion, a lot of the land is now used for tobacco. The soil and the climate is so perfect for the types of vegetables you grow. Obviously, they're endemic to the land, but these tobacco fields have just taken over. You're very, very particular about going against the agribusiness industry and the sort of monopolization of this land. I think of it also as a land grab.
Oh, absolutely. And I just want to emphasize that this is not unique to Palestine. In different places in the world, different policies have destroyed the soil. And these are by design again, because agribusiness fundamentally does not believe that soil matters. And if you don't believe soil matters, you'll do whatever with soil, first of all. Second of all, we have obviously governments that are interested, very much invested in destroying a people's ability to grow their own food. As we say in Arabic, if you don't eat from your axe, you can't think with your own mind. Here in what's called the United States, they have destroyed and taken over the Native American prairies, the indigenous people's foodways, and turned them into agribusiness farms, but also brought in a system with the settlers that is very much a system of commodification of nature. And so we live in a system today where we go to the grocery store, and we have learned that the grocery store is where we get our food. And it sounds like, oh, this is, of course, the hip thing to say, oh, we shouldn't eat from the grocery store, we should grow our food. But if you really think about it, even somebody like me who grew up in a place where I grew my food, I am disconnected. And I rely on the supermarket to a great extent because I have been displaced from my land. It is by design, by policy, that humans in different societies are being pushed to be reliant on companies to eat, to survive. And this allows for more control, obviously. When you are in a place like Palestine, it's the same policy. It's just a bit more clear because you are dealing with a society that still has connection to land. So what do? You make it so difficult for them to survive, either by poisoning their land, forcing them off their land, or creating new policies under the name of peace or whatever. Resistance today for Palestinians is as simple as getting up in the morning and going to try to find food for your family. And for that, you can get killed.
It's literally life or death every minute of the day. I want to ask about, because you use the word resistance, and I think it's really important to define that as it relates to your work, which is a different type of resistance, I think a really powerful one. And I want to start with this question around your intentionality of naming it a library and not a bank.
Yeah, thanks for this question. A lot of people interview me and they still say, "Your seed bank." And I'm like, obviously, I am not. So yeah, the idea of creating a seed library came as a way to say that, first of all, life belongs to life and seeds are that. And so I did not want it to be a bank where you have to go through a big process to access the seeds. It started with just actually a few jars that I collected. And then I started sharing with folks. And the idea is to keep the seeds in the hands of people and not companies. And so it is a form of creation, meaning how do we create communities with the design that we want of what kind of people we want to be, what kind of seed we want to be, because in the end, obviously, we are seeds and we are mud. And so even if we don't survive in mass, or even if just a few of us survive, at least we would have survived in the integrity of what we wanted to be. And then we actually have been in communication with a young man named Yusuf Saqr, who told me a story that he, after the bombing of his home, he went and he found a dead chili, and he took the seeds and planted them. And he started to also do that with other things, but he was targeted and killed for that very specific reason. He was a young man in his 20s. So it's very tragic, of course, but to be able to grow these seeds and to have chili now and to be able to pass it down and to keep it alive has been helpful for us as we are experiencing so much injustice, so much hurt, to have some life promise, which the seed like looks so gone and dead, sprouts, and then you feel like maybe there is some hope. So it's more about creating conditions for us to remember that life is still possible. And I know this sounds very simple, but it's actually really huge when the whole world wants to kill you, that you still see that parts of you wants to live is actually the greatest form of resistance. And it's not always easy. It's probably the hardest part.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I would love to know, is there a way for folks to get involved with planting these seeds and tending to the soil?
So since this genocide started, we started a new program, which is a program called the Seed Protectors. And what we do with this program is that people grow some Palestinian heirloom seeds. We now have with more than 50 farmers around the U.S. And what we're doing is basically giving seeds refuge in hopes that they will one day go home, but also giving people the opportunity to do something tangible. Because if you decide to be a seed protector, not only do you promise to, you know, do your best to grow these seeds and tend them, but also to give seed the next year to the seed library, but also to tell the story.
This is our first year growing this incredible Palestinian okra. I've never seen okra that is this big and this glorious before.
So this year we're growing the bamye okra from Palestine Heirloom Seed Library. This partnership with the seed library has been the most powerful part of our work this year, especially since October 7th.
This is the first fucus we have picked, thanks to Vivian Sansor and the Palestinian Heirloom Seed Library. And this is my first time trying fucus. Oh my goodness. That is like a crisp, sweet, supple cucumber melon. I love it.
We also have seeds that we have planted in honor of the thousands of people who have been killed. Many of these seeds were planted with particular names, and those seeds have sprouted also. And we would like to keep them alive for eternity, obviously. This project is important because it allows us to keep hope alive to some extent, to tell the true story, to bear witness, and also to keep the culture alive through planting these culturally significant crops. This is like an attempt to continue life, even if it's being under attack, and it's our gift to the world.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. As seasons change and days grow darker sooner, it can be a tough time for many. That's why it's important to stay connected. It's time to reach out and check in with those you care about, and to remind ourselves that we're not alone. This November, BetterHelp is encouraging everyone to check in on friends, reconnect with loved ones, and let them know that you're there. Just as it can take a little courage to send that message or grab coffee with someone you haven't seen in a while, reaching out for therapy can feel difficult too, but it's worth it. And it almost always leaves people wondering, why didn't I do this sooner? With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is one of the largest online therapy platforms, having served over 5 million people globally. And BetterHelp has an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. This month, don't wait to reach out. Whether you're checking in on a friend or reaching out to a therapist yourself, BetterHelp makes it easier to take that first step. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/TheNation. That's BetterHelp.com/TheNation. This holiday season, comfort means slowing down and finding calm amid the chaos. Create your natural oasis by prioritizing rest, comfort, and connection with Avocado Green Mattress. As the holidays fill up with gatherings and to-do lists, Avocado mattresses and home essentials provide the foundation for deeper rest, calmer mornings, and a healthier daily routine. Every product is thoughtfully made with the planet in mind, so you can feel good about the comfort and quality you bring into your home. Avocado is better for you and better for the planet. And to make your purchase more accessible, you'll have easy financing options with Affirm. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
There's a particular story I want to ask about. Tell me if I'm pronouncing this correctly. The Jaduai.
Correct. Excellent job.
I really wanted to pronounce it right. Jaduai watermelon from Jenin holds a very special place in your work. If you can share like the significance of this watermelon to Palestine and to you personally.
I spent a lot of time living in the Jenin area. And during my time there, I met a lot of farmers and a lot of people in general who always talked about this watermelon. First of all, it also actually grew with no irrigation in the valley. It is ancient. People during the war and during the Nakba, they hid in the watermelon fields. Women even talk about giving birth in the watermelon fields because like they worked the fields and they love the watermelon fields. And so people had a lot of beautiful memories of the time of the Jaduai when they had abundance.
What time frame was that?
That's probably anywhere before the 60s. And so it's older folks who remember the Jaduai. And so the more I asked about this watermelon, the more people were like, well, it doesn't exist anymore. You're asking about the dinosaur. And so when someone tells me something so amazing existed, but no, you can't have it anymore, it became like a...
An obsession.
An obsession for me to be like...
Because you seem to be like a very curious person.
Well, I think I'm a stubborn person.
That's the best quality though. Come on.
I don't know. Ask my mom. She will disagree with you. So anyway, I didn't accept their answer as the dinosaur and I kept looking and for 6 years actually passed. And then I was back in my hometown in Bejala, which is in the south. And I went into a shop of a lovely person. His name is Abu Ghattas. And I said, hey, have you ever heard of this watermelon called Jaduai? And he just laughed. And he runs a car parts store. And he was like, oh, yeah, I have some. Take them. Yeah, it was very random.
Why did he have it?
He has it because he is also an incredible farmer, a person who knows so much about land, farming, seeds. I mean, he wouldn't choose a car parts store if he had access to his land, but he still loves it so much. He kept seed. He kept working as much as he could 4 years ago he gave me all the seeds he has because he said he just can't, he can't anymore. It was one of the saddest moments, really. But he still is passionate about it. And I think if you give him a piece of land, he'll just do miracles with it. But even the piece of land where he works, it's not very accessible anymore because there's a settler there. So it's just like a story after story, you know, nobody is not impacted, right?
This traveling kitchen concept is really sweet, and it's where you bring Palestinian food and stories to the world. I would love to know what you've learned on these journeys and how you're able to connect people through food and this role of joy and resistance.
Yeah, the traveling kitchen has been quite the journey. It started literally and in our little backyard, and then it kind of developed wings and has been flying all over the world. We continue to grow in different ways. And I love that it takes shape in different forms. Sometimes it's just on a farm when there's no kitchen and we just harvest together as a community and we cook together, we make a fire, and it's very, very humble, very simple. But in all situations, the end result is the same. And we're creating spaces where we can eat our history instead of talk about it as if it's something in the past. So we continue to cook these things that people stop cooking or people don't know about. Like, I remember we did an event in Pennsylvania, and True Love Seeds have a farm and they planted mlochiyeh, which is a kind of mallow. But there were a Haitian family there, and they were so touched because they also miss this very same plant, because the plant originates from Africa. So the plant became a vessel for us to talk about our wounds, but also talk about the beauty of where we come from and learn from each other, because we need each other right now. I need to learn from people who have endured the worst kind of torture, slavery, oppression. How did they make it through? How are they making it through still? And also offer whatever we are doing to make it through. And so we need each other in a time when everything is collapsing on us. How do we, as a, not as nations, but as people, like, because at the end of the day, I am not someone who is committed to a nation state. I don't care if it's called Palestine or Smurfland. I care about everyone being able in the world to live in dignity and to have beauty and to have peace. The traveling kitchen allows us to imagine that something else is possible. At least at this dinner table, something else is possible.
So Vivian, my last question is, what do you think is the most important thing we can do right now as allies to support Palestinians in their fight for survival, for their land, and ultimately for liberation?
That's a great question. And I think a lot of people keep asking me, what can I do for Palestine? And I want to say to folks, forget about Palestine. Why don't you focus on your own participation in the systems that actually cause the destruction of Palestine, of Sudan, of Congo, of Haiti, of India, of wherever? What I would love people to do, don't accept the BS that we are being fed. Like, I think that the most important part is that we challenge the status quo. Accepting things because that's how they are is what got us to where we are today, where we are watching murder and we cannot do anything about it. That's because over the years, we've allowed ourselves to swallow one thing at a time that is unacceptable. We accept unacceptable things in this world. But I think what we need to do is beyond just save Palestine. We need to save everybody in order, like, you have to save yourselves, because Palestine is actually dying in order for the world to wake up. But in order for us to change things, we must change what we accept. And we have accepted mainstream media to tell us lies, keeping your mouth shut because you're afraid to lose this or that. Talking about, for example, genocide as if it's just an intellectual conversation. Oh, well, that's their opinion. No, this is not a matter of opinion. This is a matter of life and death. So accepting that and then challenging where your money is. Like, where is your money? Where is your money being invested? Are you actually keeping track of that? And like the president of Colombia said recently, and I rarely quote presidents, but he did say something very important for the world to hear, which is that Palestine is the test run to see how much you're willing to tolerate. And the world has shown that it will tolerate a lot. So be careful because you are next. And I've said this from the beginning of this genocide, that as long as Americans and Europeans in particular are willing to be quiet, are willing to take the shit they eat, they are far from free. I mean, it's just this illusion of freedom. And if we're willing to die for our freedom, we ask you to fight for your freedom so that, you know, you don't have systems that continue to kill other people to exist. If this country does not acknowledge and come to terms with the fact that it is built on the blood of the people of this land, then it can never provide any healing or solution. And we must not continue to accept the mediocrity of this world. So I would say, if you want to support Palestine, get free.
Thank you, Vivian. Thank you for your time, your heart, and your wisdom. What you've shared with us today is a reminder that resistance can also be creative. I think you used the word tender, which I love, and rooted in memory and care. Thank you for showing us what that looks like.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm deeply grateful to Vivian for trusting us with her story during such an extraordinarily vulnerable time. Speaking the truth when so many would rather look away is itself an act of courage. As the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish once wrote, "We have on this land what makes life worth living." Vivian reminds us that there are still seeds of beauty, care, and resistance taking root in the soil. And as long as we're willing to be quiet, we're far from free. Thank you to Wild Seeds Fund for making this podcast possible. This episode of A People's Climate is executive produced by Mindy Raymaker, with engineering and sound design by Francisco Nunez Capriles. Theme music by Caffrey J and additional research by Sarah Morgan. Recorded at Studio 132 in Oakland. From Counterstream Media and The Nation, I'm your host, Shilpi Chotre. Until next time.